Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Ezekiel chapter 19, which I will entitle A Lament for the Princes of Israel. Some introductory material here. First of all, when did this prophecy come? It's the same date as Ezekiel chapters 8 through 19. The date is somewhere between 592 and 590. We know this date because of Ezekiel 8:1. In the sixth year of the month, I was sitting in the house, and then the hand of the Lord of God came down on Ezekiel in the sixth year. That's the sixth year of the exile in 597, the one that took 10,000 people and Ezekiel to Babylon. So 597 minus 6 is 591. Go before and after a little bit, and you get somewhere between 592 and 590. And of course, this date is significant because it was just a few years before the Babylonian siege, which happened in 588 to 586. And of course, that's the backdrop of all of Ezekiel's prophecies. Now, in this chapter, we will encounter several metaphors, two of which are very easy, but one of which is controverted. We're going to see a lioness that refers to Judah or Israel. Let me just say this. Judah is all that's left of Israel. Sometimes she's called Judah, the southern two tribes. Sometimes she's called Israel because she's the last representative of Israel. But the lioness is Judah. And then there's a lion cub born from this lioness, the first lion cub. That's Jehoahaz. He ruled in 609 before he was carted off to Egypt by Necho II, the pharaoh. And then there's the second lion cub. Now, this second lion cub is controverted. The commentators split badly over who this guy was. The three options are three of the last four kings of Judah, all three of which were conquered by Babylon. This last second lion cub could either be Jehoiakim, who ruled from 609 to 598. I prefer that option. The second lion cub could be Jehoiachin, who ruled for 3 months between 598 and 597. Or the second lion cub could be Zedekiah, who ruled 597 to 586. Now, this creates enough permutations and combinations that it makes things a little difficult. So to simplify things, I'm going to just assume that it's Jehoiakim. I prefer that option. I'll tell you why later. So we've got Judah, the lioness, her first lion cub, Jehoahaz, the first king after Josiah got killed. His father, Josiah, got killed at Megiddo by Necho II. And then the second lion cub, I'm going to say, is Jehoahaz's elder brother, Jehoiakim. So with that background, let's begin verses 1 through 4. I'm assuming this is Yahweh speaking. He tells Ezekiel, "Take up a lament concerning the princes of Israel and say, what a lioness was your mother among the lions. She lay down among the young lions and reared her cubs. She brought up one of her cubs, and he became a strong lion. He learned to tear the prey, and he devoured men. The nations heard about him, and he was trapped in their pit. They led him with hooks to the land of Egypt." Verse 1, take up a lament. As I said, that's Yahweh speaking, even though none of my commentators bothered to tell us that was Yahweh speaking. I guess it's supposed to be obvious. So God tells Ezekiel, take up a lament, such as was used at funerals. Some bad, sad things are going to be happening concerning the princes of Israel. Verse 1, the princes of Israel. One of my commentators say that these kings were called princes instead of kings because they were subject to foreign powers. I don't know. I think it's just a translation issue here. It doesn't make that big of a deal. Now, who are these princes that the lament is about? Well, Joseph Benson says, for option number one, that the princes are Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah, the last four kings of Judah. Option number two, Kyle and Delitzsch say the lament is for the princes Jehoahaz and Jehoiachin. Option number three, the two princes are Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim. Oh, the princes are two, and they are Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim. Now, option number three is the one that I prefer. But let's go back to option number two, the idea that this lament is for Jehoahaz and Jehoiachin. Now, I know all of these J names are confusing, the three J's and the Z, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah. The only way that I can keep them apart is by their dates. Jehoahaz was the one that was carried off into Egypt in 609 after Pharaoh Necho of Egypt had come up, killed Josiah at Megiddo on his way to fight the Battle of Haran against the Babylonians, and having failed in that enterprise, came back through Judah, saw that Jehoahaz had been placed on the throne, even though he was a younger son of Josiah. Necho II, Pharaoh, he sees this. He doesn't like it. He takes Jehoahaz and takes him down to Egypt where Jehoahaz died. So Jehoahaz only ruled for a few months in 609. Now Necho II, on the way back down to Egypt, put Jehoiakim, Jehoahaz's older brother, another son of Josiah, of the deceased king Josiah. So Jehoiakim was placed on the throne by Necho. He lasted from 609 to 598. In 598, the Babylonians came, and somehow they killed Jehoiakim. The specific events of his demise are controverted, but he goes down. Jehoiachin, his brother, is put on the throne. He lasts for 3 months, between 598 and 597, and then the Babylonians, at the culmination of their siege, which they began in 598, they take Jehoiachin back in exile to Babylon, and they put Zedekiah on the throne. And Zedekiah rules from 597 to 586, the end of Judah, when the Babylonians come again and burn Jerusalem to the ground. Now, all of that is hard to keep in your head. I would suggest just getting a table somewhere and memorizing the dates, because it stands you in good stead if you want to understand not only the history in 2 Kings and Chronicles, but also the prophets Jeremiah and Ezekiel. But at any rate, let's go back to who our options are as to who these princes are that are being lamented. As I said, the first option is Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah, all of them, according to Benson. Kyle and Delitzsch and the Cambridge commentators say, no, it's only two kings that are being lamented. Jehoahaz, he's the one that ruled from 609 and went down to Egypt, captured by Necho II. And Jehoiachin, he's the three-month wonder that lasted from 598 to 597 before he was carried in captivity to Babylon. Those two. Here's what Colin Delitzsch says. The princes of Israel, to whom the lamentation applies, are so clearly pointed out in Ezekiel 19:4 and Ezekiel 19:9 that there is no mistaking Jehoahaz and Jehoiachin. Well, Colin Delitzsch are pretty cocky about it, but I've got a lot of commentators that don't agree with them. They say it's Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim. Here's what the Cambridge commentator says. Two princes are lamented, one captured and carried to Egypt, viz. Jehoahaz, son and successor of Josiah, and another carried to Babylon, who must be Jehoiachin, must be. Well, maybe, maybe not. Option number three, it's Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim, the first two of the last four kings of Judah. Jehoahaz being taken down to Egypt, where he died, and Jehoiakim being placed on the throne by Necho II. And, of course, Babylon ended up taking over Jehoiakim's allegiance after a while. Now, let me summarize all this. There's agreement on who the first prince is that's being referred to, Jehoahaz. Everybody agrees with that. It's very obvious, as we will see as we go through. But the other prince, the another cub, the second lion cub, the commentators split all over the place. Moving now to Ezekiel 19, verse 2, God says to Ezekiel, he tells Ezekiel what he's supposed to be saying to the people of Israel, "What a lioness was your mother among the lions." Actually, he's going to be speaking to the Israelites who had a mother, and that mother would be Judah, the nation of Judah, the nation of Israel. "What a lioness was your mother among the lions." So the mother is a lioness, and there's no dispute of this. Barnes, for example, says this is the people of Judah or the people of Jerusalem. Same thing. Now in verse 2, this lioness, the nation of Judah, lay down among the young lions, other lions, okay? The other lions are heathen princes surrounding Israel, Ammon, Edom, Aram, Moab, etc. And so Judah lay down among those young lions. We might include Egypt and Babylon too. And Judah reared her cubs. So the nation of Israel had two cubs. As I said, the first cub is Jehoahaz. Verse 3, the lioness, Juna, the mother, she brought up one of her cubs. Now, one of her cubs, I call her the first cub, that's Jehoahaz. He ruled in 609 for a little while before he was taken captive to Egypt. Why do we know this is Jehoahaz? Because in verse 4, it says, the nations heard about this cub, trapped him in a pit, and led him with hooks to the land of Egypt. Well, that's obviously, there was only one king that was led to Egypt, and that was Jehoahaz. So this is a no-brainer. Who this lion cub is, the first lion cub. I looked up five commentators just to be sure, Barnes, Benson, Ellicott, Poole, and Pulpit, and they all say it's Jehoahaz, so we can bank on that one. Now, Jehoahaz, in verse 3, learned to tear the prey and devoured men. John Gill comments on this, that king being instructed by evil counselors, he soon learned to oppress his subjects, to get their substance from them, and do many evil things. Gill cites 2 Kings 23:32 to back him up on that, which says, he, referring to Jehoahaz, did evil in the eyes of the Lord as his fathers had done. All right, he's an evil king. He tore, he devoured. Verse 4, the nations heard about Jehoahaz. Who are the nations? Well, everybody knew about Jehoahaz, but especially Egypt. Now, one commentator has speculated that the reason the plural is used for nations is because Egypt was composed of people from many nations, in other words, many people groups, and so the nations refers to Egypt, who trapped Jehoahaz in Egypt's pit. Those nations, under Pharaoh Necho II, led him with hooks, that's the way you carry off captives, with hooks, to the land of Egypt. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculate that Jehoahaz probably provoked Pharaoh by trying to avenge the death of his father Josiah by assailing the bordering cities of Egypt. That's just speculation. I don't think anybody knows that for sure. But I'm sure Jehoahaz was upset because his father Josiah had been killed at Megiddo in 609. At any rate, Jehoahaz ends up dying in Egypt and we no longer hear from him. We read about his death in 2 Kings 23, verses 33 through 34. Pharaoh Necho imprisoned him, that's Jehoahaz, at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that's present-day Lebanon, in Khorli, Syria, between the Lebanon and anti-Lebanon ranges. That was a staging area for incoming armies. Pharaoh Necho imprisoned Jehoahaz at Riblah in the land of Hamath to keep him from reigning in Jerusalem, and he imposed on the land a fine of 7,500 pounds of silver and 75 pounds of gold. Then Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, son of Josiah, king in place of his father Josiah, and changed Eliakim's name to Jehoiakim. But Necho took Jehoahaz and went to Egypt, and he, Jehoahaz, died there. We move now to Ezekiel 19, verses 5 through 6. When she, that's the lioness, the mother, Judah, saw her hope unfulfilled because Jehoahaz had been taken down to Egypt and captured, her expectation gone, she, that's the mother, the lioness, she took another of her cubs and made him a strong lion. So this is another king of Judah. And as I said in the introduction, people split all over the place as to who this other king was. Verse 6, he prowled among the lions, for he was now a strong lion. He learned to tear the prey, and he devoured men. I mentioned in verse 5 that the mother lion, Judah, saw her hope unfulfilled because Jehoahaz never came back from Egypt because he was dead. There was another thing that caused Judah's hope to be unfulfilled. She was never able to have the tribute that she owed Egypt lifted from her head. So she took another of her cubs, and as I said earlier in the introduction, you got three options here. Jehoiakim, who ruled from 609 to 598, that was Jehoahaz's older brother. Jehoiachin, option number two, he ruled from 598 to 597 for 3 months. That was Jehoiakim's son. Option number three is Zedekiah, the last king, who ruled from 597 to 586. He was Jehoiakim and Jehoahaz's brother and Jehoiachin's uncle. Well, let's look at why I prefer to take Jehoiakim as the second lion cub. First of all, in verse 6, the text says that this second lion cub tore prey and devoured men. Now, Jehoiakim did that more than Jehoiachin did. Jehoiachin was just a mere youth who ruled for only 3 months. How did he have time to tear prey and devour men? Most of my commentators say it's Jehoiakim, and that's another reason I prefer this option, even though I respect Kyle and Delitzsch, who say it's obvious that it's Jehoiachin, not Jehoiakim. So we're going to take Jehoiakim as the second lion cub. Eliakim, of course, was his original name. Pharaoh Necho II had changed Eliakim to Jehoiakim and put him on the throne. The Israelites consented to that, according to John Gill. I guess they had no choice. Now in verse 6, this second lion cub prowled among the lions, for he was now a strong lion. Well, who are these other lions that Jehoiakim is prowling among? Well, that would be Necho of Egypt and Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Jehoiakim is caught between the two. So Jehoiakim is a strong lion. He learned to tear the prey and he devoured men. John Gill says that Jehoiakim was notorious for his acts of injustice and arbitrary power, for the detaining the wages of workmen, and for his oppression, violence, and rapine, and shedding of innocent blood. Gill cites Jeremiah 22, 13, and 17 to back him up. Jeremiah 22, 13 says this, and that verse has a heading called A Message Concerning Jehoiakim, so we know it's referring to Jehoiakim. Woe for the one who builds his palace through unrighteousness, his upper rooms through injustice, who makes his fellow man serve without pay and will not give him his wages. Ooh, that's bad. You don't meet payroll. Jeremiah 22:17. But you, Jehoiakim, have eyes and a heart for nothing except your own dishonest profit, shedding innocent blood and committing extortion and oppression. That's why I think it's Jehoiakim and not Jehoiachin. Adam Clark says that Jehoiakim was a monster of iniquity. And so that fits pretty well with verse 6 of Ezekiel 19. He, Jehoiakim, learned to tear the prey and he devoured men. Jeremiah backs that up. So that's why I think it's Jehoiakim. Lion cub number 2. We go now to Ezekiel 19, verses 7 through 9. He, I'm assuming that's Jehoiakim, broke down their strongholds and devastated their towns. The land and all who were in it were terrified by his roaring. Then the nations came against him, those from regions round about. They spread their net for him, and he was trapped in their pit. With hooks they pulled him into a cage and brought him to the king of Babylon. They put him in prison, so his roar was heard no longer on the mountains of Israel. In verse 7, the text says that he broke down their strongholds, and once again I'll run through the options. Option number 1, that's Jehoiachin, 598 to 597. Kylan Dillich likes that option. They say that the princes of Israel to whom the lamentation applies are so clearly pointed out in Ezekiel 19:4 and Ezekiel 19:9 that there is no mistaking Jehoahaz for cub number 1 and Jehoiachin for cub number 2. Again, I'll repeat this. If I had the learned Kylan Dillich in front of me, I would say, well, what breaking down of strongholds and devastation did Jehoiachin do in a mere 3 months? Because verse 7 says that this second lion cub, broke down their strongholds and devastated their towns. I don't see Jehoiachin doing that. But Jehoiakim, who ruled from 609 to 598, it seems that that would fit him. As John Gill says, Jehoiakim took notice of the palaces or seats of the richest men of the nation and pillaged them of their treasure and wealth, and so they became desolate. Jehoiakim devastated their towns. As Gill says, by putting the inhabitants to death or obliging them to leave them and retire elsewhere, not being able to pay the taxes he imposed upon them, partly to support his own grandeur and luxury, and partly to pay the tribute to the king of Egypt. Now, admittedly, Gill is extrapolating a little bit, and so his argument is not a slam-dunk argument, but I believe it makes a lot more sense than Jehoiachin does, despite the learned opinion of Kyle and Dillich and the Cambridge commentary. Of course, there's another option as to who this he is. Could be Zedekiah. In verse 7, the he that's breaking down the strongholds and devastating the towns of Judah. That could be Zedekiah. But that, of course, happened after the prophecy was given. He was carried off to Babylon in 586. This prophecy was given somewhere around 592 to 590. So we're going to throw out Zedekiah as an option. We will tip our hat to Kylan Dillich, who choose Jehoiachin, but we're going to go with the majority here. Jehoiakim, Benson, Gill, Clark, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown all say it's Jehoiakim. So, Judah and all who were in Judah were terrified by Jehoiakim's roaring because of his oppression, because he was a jerk. Verse 8, then the nations came against him. Benson said those would be the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, the Syrians, the Moabites, and the Ammonites, all of whom were in the Babylonian army. We read, as a matter of fact, explicitly that these nations came against Jehoiakim in 2 Kings 24, verses 1 through 2. During Jehoiakim's reign, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, attacked. Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years, and he turned and rebelled against him. The Lord sent Chaldean, Aramean, Moabite, and Ammonite raiders against Jehoiakim. So all of these raiders were probably under the guidance of Babylon. He sent them against Judah to destroy it. So I think this is another reason why Jehoiakim works better than Jehoiachin as to who this he was, this second lion cub who's breaking down all the strongholds and devastating the towns of Judah, and who terrified the towns of Judah by his roaring. So in verse 8, the nations came against him, as I just said, those from regions around about. So they, that would be all those under the Babylonian Empire, spread their net for Jehoiakim, and he was trapped in their pit. With hooks, they pulled him into a cage and brought him to the king of Babylon. They put him in prison. Now, here we have to deal with an historical issue. It is very controverted as to exactly how Jehoiakim went down. So I'm going to run through this sort of quickly, sort of a rabbit trail, but it's an interesting rabbit trail. John Gill says, it is certain that he, referring to Jehoiakim, was bound in fetters in order to be carried to Babylon, though it is thought he never reached thither, but died on the way. Gill cites 2 Chronicles 36:6, which says, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jehoiakim, and bound him with bronze chains to take him to Babylon. Now notice that verse doesn't say that Jehoiakim was taken to Babylon, just that he was bound with bronze chains in order to be taken to Babylon. John Gill, referring to Babylon there, says, where it seems before he came to Babylon, he died and was cast out on a dunghill and had no burial as Jeremiah foretold. Adam Clark contradicts that. He says, no, Jehoiakim continued in prison many years till the reign of evil Merodach, who came after Nebuchadnezzar. Evil Merodach set him at liberty, but never suffered Jehoiakim to return to the mountains of Israel. Well, right there you can see there's a problem. This Jehoiakim, was he killed? Was he cast out on a dunghill and had no burial before he made it to Babylon? Did he make it to Babylon? We talked about this in Jeremiah. I don't have the site in front of me, but Jeremiah predicted that, as Gill points out. And the question is, well, how did that happen? All right, so to summarize all this, I'm going to read you a section from Wikipedia to show you how the circumstances of Jehoiakim's death are highly controversial. Quote, the manner and even the venue of the death of Jehoiakim is the subject of more controversy than is involved in the life of any other king of the divided kingdoms, northern and southern. Some authorities suggest that when the Bible says that Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, it means that Jehoiakim died peacefully. But Jeremiah mentions many baleful prophecies that, taken together, suggest that Jehoiakim's body was exposed to the elements and that he did not have a proper burial. Some authorities suggest that Jehoiakim's own people threw him over the wall of Jerusalem to convince the besieging Chaldeans that he was dead. Oded Lipschitz of Tel Aviv University in Israel presents an elaborate argument to the effect that Jehoiakim did indeed die peacefully. Yet his analysis dismisses Jeremiah's prophecy as in essence false, and we're not going to do that. Prophets of God have never foretold anything that has been shown not to have come to pass when those prophets said it would. Now this is from Wikipedia, taking a high view of prophecy. That's very nice. Although some, including Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and of course John the Revelator, have foretold events that some say are yet to come to pass, Usher, indeed, saw no conflict between Jeremiah's baleful prophecies and the expression he slept with his fathers. The Bible nowhere says that he was buried with his fathers. Usher gives perhaps the simplest resolution that fits all the Bible texts that bear on this issue, that Jehoiakim was dragged out of the city gate by a chariot and left exposed on the ground. Whether his own people killed him and tossed him over the wall, or whether Nebuchadnezzar captured him and executed him first, remains an open question. Wikipedia's discussion is trying to reconcile three verses. First, 2 Kings 24:6, Jehoiakim rested with his fathers, and his son Jehoiachin became king in his place. I'm going to assume that just means he died. Doesn't mean he had a nice burial. If he had a nice burial, that would contradict the second verse here that I'm going to read, Jeremiah 22:18-19. Therefore, this is what the Lord says concerning Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah. They will not mourn for him, saying, woe, my brother, or woe, my sister. They will not mourn for him, saying, woe, Lord, woe, his majesty. He will be buried like a donkey, dragged off and thrown outside the gates of Jerusalem. Well, that's not a problem to reconcile the resting with his father's reference in 2 Kings 24, verse 6, and Jeremiah 22:18-19, that says that Jehoiakim did not have an honorable burial. No problem. But now we get to 2 Chronicles 36:6, the third verse. Now Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, attacked Jehoiakim, and bound him in bronze shackles to take him to Babylon. Now how do we fit that in? Well, without having studied the issue too closely, I will give you my amateurish effort in order to reconcile. Nebuchadnezzar comes up. He's outside the siege walls. The people in Jerusalem realize they're cooked. They want to surrender. Jehoiakim doesn't. So they take Jehoiakim and they toss him over the wall. This, of course, does not advance Jehoiakim's state of health too much. Nebuchadnezzar grabs him, puts shackles on him, and says, okay, we got the king. We'll take him back to Babylon. But Jehoiakim is in bad shape. And before he can be carried to Babylon, he dies from his injuries. And so Nebuchadnezzar takes the corpse and says, okay, I'm going to throw this out here like throwing out dung on a dunghill. I'm going to bury him like a donkey. I will leave that to all of your aspiring Old Testament PhD students. That is a rabbit trail. The point is, as we go back to our text in Ezekiel 19, verse 9, with hooks they pulled him, I'm assuming it's Jehoiakim, into a cage and brought him to the king of Babylon. Now, he was put into a cage and brought to the king of Babylon. That could be the people of Jerusalem putting him into a cage so they could deliver him to Babylon. That's the Babylonians, put him in prison so his roar was heard no longer on the mountains of Israel. That prison would be outside the gates of Jerusalem, not in Babylon. We go now to Ezekiel 19, verses 10 through 14, and we will finish this chapter. Yahweh continues to tell Ezekiel what to tell the people, or to tell the two princes, more precisely, the two princes for whom this lament was written. Your mother was like a vine in your vineyard planted by the water. It was fruitful and full of branches because of abundant water. Its branches were strong, fit for a ruler's scepter. It towered high above the thick foliage, conspicuous for its height and for its many branches. But it was uprooted in fury and thrown to the ground. The east wind made it shrivel. It was stripped of its fruit. Its strong branches withered, and fire consumed them. Now it is planted in the desert in a dry and thirsty land. Fire spread from one of its main branches and consumed its fruit. No strong branches left on it, fit for a ruler's scepter. This is a lament and is to be used as a lament. Now, just to summarize this, this is talking about Judah going down to the Babylonians in 586 BC. Let's start with the first two words of verse 10, your mother. First, mother. That's easy. The mother is either Judah or Jerusalem, the capital city of Judah. Barnes says it's either Judah or Jerusalem. Benson says it's Judah. Kyle and Dillich say the mother is the national community, the theocracy out of which the kings were born, as is indisputably evident from Ezekiel 19:10. So the mother is Judah. Who does the your refer to, your mother? Well, the commentators split all over the place on this. Barnes says that the your refers to Jehoiachin's mother. Barnes says, quote, Jehoiachin is still addressed. Pulpit commentator says, quote, Jehoiachin, who is still in Ezekiel's thoughts and is addressed by him. I don't know why, because we've already decided that the two kings are, the two lion cubs, are Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim, not Jehoiachin. But again, all this is very controversial. Kyle and Dillich say the Yor that's being referred to here is Jehoahaz and Jehoiachin. Yor, Jehoahaz and Jehoiachin's mother, Judah, is like a vine. Cambridge commentator says it's Zedekiah. Your mother Zedekiah was like a vine. Now, that might seem a little bit off the wall, but as we see as we go through these verses, Jeremiah is going to jump from history to a prophetic prediction of what's going to happen to the last king, Zedekiah. And so Cambridge just assumes that the your there is referring to Zedekiah, your mother Zedekiah. Benson says it's Jehoiakim, assuming the second lion cub is Jehoiakim. So we're not going to worry about it. One of the kings of Israel had a mother, Judah, who was like a vine. Now, of course, Israel is often compared to a vine in the Old Testament, as we know. Now, we have a translation issue. Your mother was like a vine in your vineyard. That in your vineyard is a problem. The NIV footnote says that two Hebrew manuscripts say, your mother was like a vine in your vineyard. But most Hebrew manuscripts say, your mother was like a vine in your blood. Well, let's take blood, for the sake of argument, as the correct translation. What would that mean? Well, I've got five possible meanings, none of which are very convincing. Your mother, Judah, was like a vine in your, let's say, Zedekiah's blood. In other words, in the line of the house of Judah. So Judah was like a vine in the fact that there was the house of Judah, which was like a vine. Option number two, your mother was like a vine in your blood being poured out on the roots of the vine to make the vine more fruitful. Now, I don't know who came up with that idea. I don't know agricultural practices in the ancient Near East to know whether that makes sense or not. It sounds somewhat far-fetched to me. Here's Calvin's option number 3. Your mother, Judah, was like a vine in your blood. The blood refers to the birth of the Jewish nation, either at Mount Sinai or when Joshua took them into the Promised Land. A baby is covered in blood when it is born, and so the reference here in Ezekiel 19:10 would be, your mother, Judah, Israel, was like a vine in your blood, the blood of Israel, the king being taken as representative of all of Israel, and Israel was born in blood. So the vine of Israel was born in blood at Mount Sinai or in the Canaan land. That's Calvin's solution. Option number 4, a vine planted by the waters was done so in order to produce the blood of the grape. So your mother, Judah, was like a vine in your vineyard which produces grape juice, blood, the blood of a grape. Now that's a stretch. Here's option number 5 by Ellicott. Thy mother is like a vine living in the blood, i.e. in the life of her children. So we would read it this way. Your, meaning whichever king we are addressing here, let's say Zedekiah, your mother, Judah, was like a vine in your blood, in your life, in the life of her children, your blood, meaning your blood descendants. So your mother is living like a vine in the descendants of Israel. That's another stretch. That's probably why the NIV didn't translate it as vine, but rather vineyard. Let's look at some other translations of this problematic word. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as vineyard. The Holman Christian Study Bible marginal note says that some Hebrew manuscripts translate it as vineyard. Other Hebrew manuscripts read blood, and that's why we have the problem. Now, the old translations, the American Standard Version, the KJV, the Young's Literal Translation, they all translate the word as blood. The Bible in Basic English says this, your mother was in comparison like a vine. It doesn't say a vine in a vineyard or a vine in blood. A vine in your vineyard or a vine in your blood. It just leaves it out. Punts. That's what I'm going to do in just a minute. God's Word and the New American Bible do exactly the same thing. They just leave the word out. Not worth messing with, I guess. The Darby translation has, your mother was as a vine in thy rest, not in thy blood, not in thy vineyard, but in thy rest. A new option. The Darby marginal note says, others translate like unto thee. Your mother was as a vine like unto thee, like you were a vine. But the reading is uncertain, obviously. The Septuagint has, your mother was as a flower on a pomegranate tree. Well, it's obviously nobody can interpret the Hebrew to translate it properly. So here's my conclusion. There are problems with both blood and vineyard as a translation. Nobody agrees on what blood might mean, as I just pointed out to you, but vineyard is difficult to understand too. Why would Judah be a vine in a vineyard? Let's read it that way. Your mother, Judah, was like a vine in your vineyard. Well, Judah is a vineyard. Why would it just be one vine in the vineyard? Judah is the vineyard. It's the whole vineyard. That doesn't make sense to me either. So I like the Bible in Basic English, God's Word, and New American Bible translation. They just leave it out. And that's what I'm going to do. Now we go to verse 11. This vine had branches that were strong, fit for a ruler's scepter. Now this is referring to previous kings of Judah. For example, David, Solomon, Josiah. And the vine's branches were strong enough for a ruler's scepter. Now generally a vine's branch is not that strong. But here in the metaphor, the vine branches are very strong. Strong enough to make a scepter. Of course, a scepter is a rod, which is a symbol of a ruler's authority. John Gill says this, scepters of the ancients, which were no other than walking sticks, cut off of the stems or branches of trees and decorated with gold or studded with golden nails. So a vine would suit that properly, I think. But the point is, of course, is that Israel used to have strong rulers, and now Israel's going to be burnt up with fire. Continuing in verse 11, this vine, the mother vine we might call it, the kingdom of Judah, it towered high above the thick foliage. Towered because it was strong. John Gill takes it as a vine that's like a trunk of a tree which rises higher than its branches. For example, the nation of David and Solomon towered over its neighbors. Solomon was the most powerful king in the ancient Near East. at the time, more powerful than Egypt, more powerful than Aram, Syria, more powerful than Assyria. And so Ezekiel, or God through Ezekiel, is referring to the ancient glories of Israel. That's the good news. Verse 12, but it, the vine, was uprooted in fury and thrown to the ground. This, I'm going to take it, most probably refers to the destruction of Judah in 586, when Babylon uprooted Judah in fury and threw it to the ground. The east wind made it shrivel. That's because Babylon is to the east. And of course, back then, the east wind coming off that desert in the east was hot and powerful and dangerous. The east wind made the vine shrivel. It was stripped of its fruit. Obviously, the last kings were pathetic little weaklings. Its strong branches withered. Now, here are some options as to who these withered branches might refer to. John Gill says it's King Jehoiachin, who ruled for 3 months in 598 to 597, who with his mother, wise princes and officers and the mighty of the land, even all the mighty men of valor with the craftsmen and smiths, were taken and carried captive. It could be Zedekiah, these strong branches that were withered. Colin Delicious takes it as a metaphor for powerful kings in general. Poole says it's all the choice men, the counselors, warriors, artificers, and all that were like to be the strength of the kingdom were broken by Nebuchadnezzar's hand, plucked away and removed into Babylon, where they lay as withered branches. And of course, that would probably be in the 586 event, not the 597 event. In verse 12, we're told that the east wind from Babylon made the vine shrivel, no fruit. The fruit would be referring to the people. The vine in Israel shriveled with no fruit because the people were carried off into Babylon. Not all of them, of course, but we get the idea. Stripped of most of its fruit, I guess we could say. So the strong branches, either the nobles or previous princes, whoever might be, they were withered. Fire consumed them. That fits 586 BC pretty good, when fire burnt down Jerusalem. Now, in verse 13, now is referring to the time that Ezekiel is speaking. Most probably it's a, could be a temporal reference. It might not be, but as Ezekiel speaks in 592 to 590 BC, this is before 586. Now, Jerusalem is planted in the desert in a dry and thirsty land. That would be Babylon. Fire spread from one of its main branches. That would be Zedekiah, and consumed its fruit. So Zedekiah gets torched. That happened in 586. No strong branches left on it fit for a ruler's scepter, because Zedekiah was the last king. He's toast. No more king in the house of Judah until Jesus shows up. And then Ezekiel finishes chapter 19 by saying this is a lament and is to be used as a lament. In other words, let's sing this sad stuff until we see what happens in 586. Now, I assumed that the main branch in verse 14 that was consumed was the last king Zedekiah. And just to show you how probably right I am about that, and how right I am that this fire refers to 586, the literal fire that consumed Jerusalem in 586, let me show you how many commentators agree with that sentiment. And I'm sure there are more. I got tired of looking. Jameson, Fawcett and Brown, Barnes, Ellicott, Cambridge, Colin Delitzsch, Poole, Pulpit. So we can be assured that Ezekiel is predicting now, not giving us an historical narrative. He's predicting, because he's writing before 586. He's writing between 592 to 590 BC. He is predicting the downfall of Jerusalem. That's pretty sad. Probably a check on all those exiles in Babylon who thought that they were going to be going back quickly to their native land. It was not to be. So on that sad note, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Ezekiel 19, and we are prepared now in our next audio to go to Ezekiel 20, verses 1 through 32, first half of that long chapter. And that audio I will call Israel's Continuing Rebellion. I hope you stay tuned for our discussion of that. And I hope you enjoyed the discussion of chapter 19 in Ezekiel.